Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a look at some expert sources covering emergency medical management, and we're going to plunge into what has to be one of the most high-stakes areas.
Yeah.
Severe trauma to the face and neck.
Yeah, definitely high stakes. Fast-moving, too.
Right. And our mission, really, is to sort of pull apart the critical difference between injuries that just look horrific and those that are, you know, genuinely life-threatening right now.
Yeah.
Because according to the material we've reviewed, the biggest hazard here isn't always the injury itself. It's more like the cognitive trap it sets.
That's exactly it. It's what some call the paradox of trauma. These injuries, face and neck, they are almost always very graphic, as the sources put it. You see significant swelling, maybe deformity, lots of blood, and your immediate instinct is just fix that big, obvious problem.
Makes sense.
But the number one instruction, the absolute primary rule from the field experts is do not focus only on those surface injuries and miss the hidden, the immediate life threats lurking underneath.
So we actually have to fight that visual instinct, the urge to stop the bleeding we can see first, and instead prioritize the threats we might not see immediately. Meaning the core principles, airway and circulation, they're still king, regardless of how, well, messy it looks on the surface.
Precisely. Airway circulation, always. And the anatomy itself, the way the face and neck are built, it kind of sets you up for high risk. Think about the face. It's got, what, 14 bones? And it's incredibly vascular, just packed with blood vessels.
Oh.
So even relatively small, soft tissue injuries, things that might not seem too deep, they can cause massive, really rapid blood loss, a significant hemorrhage. That threatens circulation very, very quickly.
High vascularity, high bleed risk.
Got it.
Yeah.
What about the structures that are more likely to threaten the airway directly?
Well, the mouth is probably the biggest one there. We all have, you know, 32 permanent teeth, normally pretty secure in the jaw's alveoli, but you apply significant force, a punch, a car crash, whatever, and those teeth, or even just fragments of them, they basically become shrapnel inside the mouth. And a really critical point, the sources stress, one that can be subtle, is that these dislodged teeth or bits of them can cause immediate catastrophic airway obstruction or aspiration where they get inhaled down into the lungs.
So that little missing tooth you might notice.
Yeah.
It's suddenly a potential killer, a choking hazard.
Exactly. A tiny hazard, potentially huge hidden problem. It's terrifying when you think about it.
Yeah, it really is. And then there are the structures around the eye. You mentioned they sound fragile.
They are, relatively speaking. Hmm. The orbits, the eye sockets, they're formed by 7 quite thin bones. They're designed partly to reduce the head's weight, but they also act a bit like a crumple zone for the skull to absorb some impact before it gets to the brain. The downside is enough direct force can cause what's called a blowout fracture. The floor of the orbit basically gives way and the eye can get pushed back or down, damaging nerves and muscles.
Okay. And if the face is the front line, then the neck.
Yeah.
That's like the main supply road, isn't it?
It really is. Probably the single highest concentration of absolutely critical structures in the body. Just in the anterior neck, the front part, you've got the trachea, your windpipe, you've got the thyroid and cricoid cartilage keeping it open, major muscles, nerves, and then the big ones. The carotid arteries pumping blood up to the brain and the jugular veins bringing it back.
So any significant trauma there isn't just a local problem.
Not at all. It's an immediate threat to the entire body's ability to breathe or get blood to the brain or manage pressure. You compress or sever just one of those major vessels or the airway. The outcome can be, well, immediate and devastating.
Okay, the stakes are definitely clear. So let's shift to the action plan, the assessment blueprint. Before you even touch the patient, you have to do that rapid scene size up. That means checking for hazards, state of precautions, number of patients, resources needed, and figuring out the mechanism of injury, the MOI. Why is that MOI so critical here?
Because the MOI, especially in trauma, it tells you what else might be going on, what hidden injuries to suspect, even if the patient initially looks, you know, okay in some ways. Was it a direct hit, a fall, high-speed crash causing acceleration-deceleration forces? That context immediately shapes your primary survey.
Which is that super fast check for the immediate life threats using the XABCDE sequence.
Right. Exsanguination, meaning catastrophic external bleeding that always comes first if it's present. Got to stop that immediately.
But with face and neck trauma, It feels like airway and breathing, the A and B, become incredibly time-sensitive, maybe the most sensitive.
They often are, absolutely. You're assessing responsiveness, listening for any sounds, gurgling, snoring, stridor, looking for chest rise, signs of distress. If that patient is unresponsive and has a significantly altered mental status, you have to assume their airway isn't protected. Intervention needs to be instant.
And that means.
That means aggressive suctioning. If there's blood, vomit, anything in there, get it out. Or immediately roll the patient onto their side if they're unresponsive to let gravity help clear it and prevent aspiration. You're also assessing for hypoxia, lack of oxygen checking saturations, aiming to keep them at 94% or higher. The absolute rule here is an obstructed airway will kill the patient fast.
Okay, moving quickly then to C, circulation. We're feeling for a pulse, checking skin color, temperature, moisture, and crucially, controlling any significant ongoing bleeding, right? Not just the initial massive bleed.
Exactly. And you're not just looking for obvious external blood loss. You're looking for the signs of shock, too.
Yeah.
Is the pulse rapid and weak? Is the skin pale, cool, clammy? That tells you the circulatory system is starting to fail, even if the bleeding isn't pouring out onto the floor. And we have to remember, something like a badly fractured jaw or even a severe nosebleed, that can cause a lot of internal bleeding down the back of the throat. It might look like just an airway problem, but it's very much a circulation failure happening, too.
Which makes the transport decision pretty straightforward then.
Usually, yes, extremely straightforward. The sources really emphasize rapid transport for any patient showing those physiological signs of instability. Any immediate life threat identified in the primary survey. If somehow they're completely stable with just an isolated injury, maybe a broken nose, but breathing fine, good pulse, okay, you might have a little more time on scene. But if messing around with, say, splinting a non-life-threatening fracture means you delay managing that airway or controlling bleeding, no, that stuff can wait. Get them moving. Time is critical.
So primary survey done, immediate threats managed or being managed en route. Now we get to the secondary assessment. This is where we're really hunting for those hidden dangers, right? The subtle clues pointing to bigger problems. What's a key sign people might miss when they're just staring at a badly swollen face?
Yeah, it's easy to get tunnel vision. One big one is the bruising. Specifically, look behind the ear. That bruising pattern, often called battle sign or retroauricular ecchymosis, it's a classic sign.
What does this signify?
It's a strong indicator of force significant enough to potentially fracture the base of the skull, a basilar skull fracture. That's a serious brain injury risk. Another critical clue, maybe even more critical, is any drainage from the ears or nose. If it's clear, maybe watery, maybe slightly pinkish, or if you blot it on gauze and see that halo sign where a yellowish ring separates from the blood.
CSF.
Highly suspicious for CSF, yeah. Cerebrospinal fluid means the barrier protecting the brain and spinal cord has been breached. Huge risk of infection, among other things.
And what about when you're actually palpating, feeling the structures? What physical signs scream instability?
Well, first, just general facial symmetry and stability. Gently feel the facial bones. Do they feel loose? Does one side feel different, unstable compared to the other? That indicates significant fractures. And in the neck, a really ominous sign is tracheal deviation. Feeling the windpipe, the trachea, has it been pushed off to one side?
Why is that so bad?
Because it means there's massive pressure building up inside the chest or neck, maybe from a collapsed lung, tension pneumothorax, or major bleeding, and it's physically shoving the airway structure over. That's an immediate massive life threat. Needs urgent decompression.
Okay, let's focus in on those maxillofacial fractures themselves. We don't need to get lost in the Lafore classifications, but what are the key consequences or signs for specific areas? Like, if the cheekbone, the zygoma, is broken, what's the tell?
Often you'll see a flattened appearance on that side of the face, yeah. But the really crucial sign is often nerve damage. The patient might report numbness, like pins and needles, right below the eye, maybe extending over the cheek, the side of the nose, the upper lip. That's the infraorbital nerve being compressed or damaged.
Numbness. Okay. Anything else?
Yes, and this is a big one. Paralysis of upward gaze. Ask the patient to look up with just their eyes if the injured eye can't move upwards properly.
What does that mean?
It tells you the fracture is likely trapping or damaging the muscles that control eye movement or the nerves supplying them. Often seen with those orbital blowout fractures we mentioned, it's a really important diagnostic clue.
That paralysis of upward gaze. Got it. What about the jaw, the mandible, if that's fractured?
Usually, the patient tells you themselves indirectly. They'll often have what's called dental malocclusion. Their teeth just don't line up right anymore. They can't bite down properly, or maybe they can't open their mouth fully. Pain is obviously a factor too.
Makes sense. And the really severe stuff when the maxilla, the upper jaw, is involved. The midface.
Yeah, when the impact is strong enough to fracture the maxilla, especially in those higher Lafort patterns, the entire midface section can become unstable. It can literally detach to some degree from the rest of the skull.
Which sounds like an airway nightmare.
It absolutely guarantees an airway nightmare because those fractured bone segments are loose, potentially mobile, and can easily obstruct the pharynx, the back of the throat. You'll see massive facial swelling almost always. And sometimes the face can actually appear elongated, kind of pulled downwards. If you see that level of instability, securing the airway becomes incredibly complex, but absolutely non-negotiable.
Okay, let's dive into maybe the most challenging management issue. That actively bleeding airway.
Yeah.
You've got massive bleeding in the mouth or pharynx. It's causing obstruction. The patient's aspirating. Trying to secure that airway seems almost impossible.
It is. It's extremely difficult. Trying to intubate past an endotracheal tube is often really complicated by all the blood, the swelling, the potential structural deformity. You just can't see. So the critical technique our sources outline involves this sort of cycle, alternating aggressive suctioning with ventilation.
How does that work?
You suction like mad for about 15 seconds max, trying to clear as much blood and debris as possible. Then you immediately stop suctioning and provide ventilatory assistance, usually with a bag valve mask, for about 2 minutes to get oxygen into the patient.
And then repeat.
And then repeat. Suction for 15, ventilate for 2, over and over. You keep doing that cycle until you either manage to clear the airway enough to see and intubate or until you reach definitive care. The rationale is, you know, you can't ventilate effectively if the airway is full of blood, but you also can't just suction continuously because the patient will become profoundly hypoxic and die from lack of oxygen. It's a really difficult balancing act.
Wow. Okay. Let's talk impaled objects. The general rule we always hear is leave them in place. Stabilize, don't remove. Does that hold true for the face and neck?
It absolutely holds true, with one really important caveat. The rule is do not remove impaled objects unless they are directly obstructing the airway or physically preventing you from establishing an airway.
So if it's sticking out of the eye socket or the side of the neck?
Stabilize it carefully where it is, pat around it, secure it so it doesn't move, and transport immediately. Trying to pull it out risks massive secondary damage, especially to blood vessels or nerves you can't see.
But there's an exception.
There is one specific exception mentioned, an object impaled through the cheek.
Through the cheek. Why is that different?
Because generally, an object going through the cheek passes through highly vascular soft tissue, yes, but it usually misses major structures like the carotid artery or critical nerves unless it goes deep towards the back. If the object itself is causing uncontrollable external bleeding, or if you need to remove it to manage the airway and you can see both ends, meaning it hasn't gone deep, there's a specific technique. You remove the object carefully but quickly, and immediately you have to pack the inside of the cheek, the hole on the inside, firmly with gauze, and at the same time apply direct pressure with more gauze on the outside. That counter pressure, inside and out, is essential to control the bleeding that will happen when you pull the object.
Okay, that makes sense. Specific scenario, specific technique. Now, eye injuries, you said the globe is sacred. If you even suspect the eyeball itself might be ruptured. Priority is just protection, right?
Absolute. Total protection. You must never exert any pressure on an injured globe. Ever. If you see signs like blood pooling in the front chamber of the eye that's called a hyphema, or if the pupil is irregular, or the eye just looks deflated, suspect rupture.
And management is?
Treat the patient carefully. A stick spinal injury if the mechanism warrants it. Cover the injured eye with a rigid shield, like the bottom of a paper cup taped securely. Not a pressure patch or compress. You want to prevent anything from touching or pressing on the eye. And if the eyeball itself is actually displaced, pushed out of the socket.
Okay.
Yeah. You stabilize it right where it is. Maybe cover it with moist, sterile gauze to keep it from drying out, then the shield over that.
Yeah.
But you do not try to push it back in or manipulate it. Stabilize and transport.
And impaled objects in the eye itself. Even tiny ones.
Same principle. Even a tiny speck on the cornea, if it's truly impaled, you stabilize it, shield the eye, and transport. Never try to remove it in the field.
So the only time we get aggressive with the eye is a chemical burn.
Exactly. That's the one exception where immediate aggressive intervention is key. Chemical burns require immediate and continuous irrigation. Flush the eye with copious amounts of sterile water or saline. For at least 5 minutes, according to some guidelines, often longer, like 20 minutes, is better if possible. The key is dilution and removal of the chemical.
And be careful not to wash it into the other eye.
Crucial point. Tilt the head so the affected eye is lower, and direct the stream from the inside corner outwards so the contaminated runoff doesn't splash into the good eye. Chemical burns just keep destroying tissue until they're neutralized or washed away. Time is tissue.
Right. Okay, lastly for management, let's touch on controlling external bleeding. Nosebleeds, epistaxis seem common. How best to manage those?
It's usually straightforward. Get the patient, if they're responsive and able, to sit up and lean slightly forward. Pinch the soft part of the nostrils firmly together. Hold that pressure for 5, maybe 10 minutes. Leaning forward stops the blood going down their throat. If they're unresponsive, position them on their side and apply pressure if possible, keeping the airway clear.
Okay, but open neck wounds. Those carry that really scary risk, don't they? Air embolism.
They absolutely do. A large vein in the neck, like the jugular, if it's torn open, the negative pressure generated when you take a breath can actually suck air directly into that vein.
And that air bubble travels.
Travels through the bloodstream, potentially reaching the heart or lungs, causing an air embolism, which can be rapidly fatal, like a blockage, but made of air.
So how do you prevent that?
You must cover any significant open neck wound immediately with an occlusive dressing. Something airtight could be commercial chest seal, or even just plastic wrap from a sterile dressing package, taped down on 3 or preferably 4 sides. Then you apply direct pressure over that dressing to control the bleeding, maybe using a bulky dressing. But when you secure it, say with roller gauze, you apply it loosely. Firm enough to hold pressure, but not so tight that you constrict the airway or other structures. Stop the air entry, control the bleed, don't choke the patient.
Got it. Occlusive dressing, direct pressure, loose wrap. Okay. We also need to make sure we don't let the drama of the big injuries totally overshadow seemingly minor things that can still have major consequences. You mentioned ears and teeth earlier.
Yeah, the ear, specifically the pinna, the external fleshy part, it actually has a pretty poor blood supply compared to, say, the face. Meaning it heals poorly if it gets damaged or lacerated. It's much more prone to infection, and cartilage damage can lead to deformity, like cauliflower ear in wrestlers. Also, ruptured eardrums can happen from direct blows or even just pressure changes, like an explosion. They often heal on their own, but can be very painful and cause hearing loss.
What if the ear is partially or fully torn off, avulsed?
Then you treat it just like any amputated part you hope to reattach. Gently rinse off any obvious debris if possible, wrap it in saline moistened sterile gauze, place that inside a sealed plastic bag, and then put that bag on ice or a cold pack. Don't let the tissue freeze directly. Transport it with the patient.
Okay, and the critical point with ears, similar to the nose, is drainage.
Yes. If you see blood or clear fluid, potentially CSF, draining from the ear canal itself, do not try to stop it. Don't pack the ear canal.
Why not?
Because if it is CSF draining from a basilar skull fracture, blocking it could increase pressure inside the skull. Just apply a loose, sterile dressing over the ear to absorb the drainage, note it, and recognize you're dealing with a probable skull fracture. And definitely don't go probing around in the ear canal looking for foreign bodies. That's for the hospital.
Right. And back to teeth one last time. We know they're an airway risk if loose or fragmented in an unstable patient. But what if a whole tooth gets knocked out cleanly in a stable patient?
If it's an adult patient and the permanent tooth is intact and relatively clean, the current pre-hospital guidelines actually suggest trying to gently rinse it, holding it by the crown, not the root, and placing it back into the socket it came from.
Really? In the field?
Yeah. Then have the patient bite down gently on some gauze to hold it in place. The sooner it's reimplanted, the better the chance it has of surviving. Transport them to a dentist or hospital immediately. If you can't replant it, transport it in milk or saline, or even tucked inside the patient's cheek if they're cooperative and won't swallow it.
But again, if the patient is unresponsive, altered, or you just can't find the tooth,
then you have to assume it's been aspirated or swallowed. That airway risk comes right back to the forefront. Search the mouth carefully, suction, and maintain a high index of suspicion for airway compromise.
Okay, this has been quite the deep dive. I think the biggest takeaway, the recurring theme, is absolutely prioritization.
Mm-hmm.
That XABCDE sequence has to be drilled in. Address massive bleeding and airway compromise immediately, almost instinctively. And crucially, recognizing that the graphic nature of many facial injuries is often a dangerous distraction. We have to consciously train ourselves to look past the blood and swelling for those subtle, but far more life-threatening signs.
Exactly. Signs like that CSF drainage, the battle sign, paralysis of upward gaze, tracheal deviation, those are the things that signal truly critical underlying problems.
And our sources also consistently remind us about prevention, don't they?
They do. Helmets, face shields, safety glasses, mouth guards during sports or high-risk work, they make a huge difference. And of course, ongoing improvements in motor vehicles, safety seat belts, airbags, headrests have significantly cut down the severity and frequency of these kinds of devastating injuries. Prevention is always better than cure.
Absolutely. So wrapping this up, what does this all really mean for you, the listener? I think the most valuable takeaway is maintaining that high index of suspicion with any significant blunt trauma mechanism. If there's enough force to break facial bones, there's almost certainly enough force to injure the cervical spine. So spinal motion restriction precautions are often necessary. And always, always be vigilant for that hidden or delayed airway compromise. Never assume a facial injury is just a facial injury. It's rarely isolated.
Yeah, and maybe a final thought to connect this to the bigger picture. Think about that dual nature of the facial skeleton we talked about. It's designed for lightness and to offer some protection. But when it fails under major impact, like in those severe maxillary fractures where the midface detaches, it's not just localized damage anymore. It's a systemic failure. The skeletal system failure directly compromises the respiratory system, the circulatory system. Everything becomes unstable. And that makes me wonder, in those high-stress, chaotic trauma calls, how much are we perhaps unconsciously trained or conditioned to focus only on the really obvious things, the big bleed, the deformed limb, and how many of those subtle but potentially catastrophic neurological signs, like that numbness below the eye, the infraorbital hypoesthesia, or that slight paralysis of upward gaze, how often might those get overlooked or dismissed in the heat of the moment? It's something to think about.